You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, Associate Director at the IEA. Welcome to our Christmas special, 2018, A Year in Review. Joining me today is our Director General, Mark Littlewood, our Research Director, Dr. Jamie White, and the Director of our Freer Initiative, Rebecca Lowe. We talk through the biggest stories of the year, ranging from the ongoing Brexit negotiations to the state of British political parties and ideologies, to other important happenings around the world. You'll also get to hear who Jamie, Mark, and Rebecca have chosen as their Person of the Year, their Event of the Year, and best of all, their top prediction for 2019. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. Rebecca, Mark, Jamie, thank you so much for joining me in the 2018 A Year in Review IEA podcast. I'm going to start with asking all three of you what your event of the year is. Rebecca, what have you picked?
So I picked the Indian Supreme Court ruling in September that decriminalised consensual gay sex. This effectively was an overturning of the 2013 ruling, which upheld Section 377, which was a sort of ancient 1860 British colonial rule talking about things like unnatural offences.
And why did you pick this particular event?
Okay, three very brief reasons. One, I think it's very easy to pick kind of Western-centric answers to a question like this, but there are 1.3 billion people living in India. It's, I think it's about 20% of the world's population. So I was quite keen to pick somewhere outside of the kind of Brexit-Trump narrative. Secondly, I think it's an interesting example of the kind of relationship between judicial and political power within a democracy. So I think we have a worrying blurring of these lines, but also at the same time, I think this kind of ruling shows that kind of successful examples of judicial rulings about these kinds of issues follow kind of cultural and social change, which has come from within kind of political activism and within the driving of norms sort of naturally. So I think that's good news. And thirdly, it was really the approach that they took. So you could imagine kind of a technocratic solution taking some kind of, I don't know, some sort of simple, tiny little sort of unheard of reason why you might want to change the constitution about this. But no, it was a kind of full-hearted, all kind of about the kind of constitutional right to privacy and against discrimination grounded on the dignity of the individual. And if you look at the judgment, it talks about things like the pursuit of happiness is founded on autonomy and dignity, and to live is to live with dignity. And I just think that's quite beautiful, really.
And a wonderful story for advancing freedom this year.
Exactly.
So thanks for starting us out on a very optimistic note. Jamie, what was your event of the year?
The tax cuts in the United States were my event of the year. They were, I think, enacted in, last year, but they came into force this year.
Mm-hmm. And why did you pick this particular event?
Well, after the financial crisis, there was a lot of kind of a return to what you might call demand management in the economy, stimulating demand when there'd been a downturn, and everybody forgot about supply-side economics. As it happens, I've just been working on a paper regarding tax, and it's reminded me of how dreadful the deadweight costs of tax are. And so here we had an intervention in the economy which moves things in the right direction on the supply side, cutting tax rates. We saw a very rapid response to it, and it's just great to see a return to that kind of thinking.
So also a very optimistic story to tell. On the other side, Rebecca, you mentioned social freedoms. Jamie, you're mentioning economic ones. Mark, yours is maybe a little bit less optimistic. What's your event of the year?
I was going to change mine. I kind of couldn't think of anything good at all, really. So I decided on the way here I was going to change it and plump for a very recent event, Southampton 3, Arsenal 2, seemed to me to be pretty much my event of the year, something that Saints fans have waited 953 days for. So the event over several years. But that seemed a
We're
bit flippant.
We're all very happy for you.
But I couldn't really, it wasn't obvious we had to pick an event of the year that we approved of.
No, you
don't.
It's
an event of note. And it's not an event as such, although I guess you could look back at last week, but a series of events, which I would describe as the continued survival of Prime Minister May, that has had various iterations, but has been of great note and will be of great note to her political historians.
And why have you decided to pick what is perhaps an event, but also perhaps just a series of moments and speeches and incidents throughout the year?
Well, because I think that in parliamentary and political terms, we're witnessing things which defy the law of normal gravity. And if that makes it extremely confusing for those of us who want to engage in public debate and thought that there were normal rules of conduct. So I would have thought that the smart money was on something in the last 12 months leading to a change of prime minister in this country. In fact, all of the sort of political gravitational pull would have been in that direction. It's a minority government. She has a large number of her own MPs who would like to see her gone. The Brexit negotiations have gone badly. She would catastrophically lose a vote on her central plank of policy, so withdrew it. She had a third of her party voting against her directly in a no-confidence motion. Yet, she stays in place. Now, some of that might speak to her characteristics as a person, but I think also it speaks to the extremely strange world of politics in which we now live. I simply can't explain her survival.
And, Rebecca, about that strange world of politics, it isn't just here in the UK, is it? It feels like in all of the developed world, politics is just exploding. You look at what's happened in France in recent weeks with the riots and Macron having to cater and almost bow down to those bashing in car windows and shop windows. You look at Angela Merkel, who became this figurehead, not just in Europe, but really in the Western world after President Obama left, to be sort of that leader in globalization. And then you also look over to the States, where you have a truly divided Congress after the midterms, and President Trump, who holds on to his base, but by doing very radical things that alienate everyone else. So, you know, going into the next year, is any of this going to calm down? And what should we make of this past year and this massive upheaval?
I don't really see this calming down. I'm hoping there might be a push for a genuine adherence to democracy, because at the moment I'm pretty depressed really about this. I think we've seen the rule of a lot of technocratic leaders. I think quite possibly that's why people are frustrating. We have highly centralised countries, particularly. I mean, if you look in the UK, it's not really surprising, I think, that people don't vote in local government elections. I mean, you just need to look at something like tax policy. I don't think people feel they really have a purchase on the direction of their lives. So some of this is to do with perception. It's to do with people whose living standards have increased, but they feel that other people aren't as well off as them. They're maybe fed certain lines by politicians trying to seek to exploit kind of misery and bad news when actually things are on the up. But I do think there's a genuine loss of a feeling that people are kind of democratically represented, whether that's because they think that their vote is being ignored, whether that's because they think that supranational technocratic institutions are increasingly ruling things. You look at the Italian budget, you look at Macron coming along and playing people off against this and against that, you look at the rise of Euroscepticism across Europe. I don't think it's surprising that people are frustrated and that they want to have a say. If they feel that the mechanisms for having a say aren't working and that their leaders are following what they might see as some form of corporate elites, kind of cronyism that we've had, which has infected our democracy in all countries, I think it's only going to continue. I just hope it leads to a real adherence to genuine democracy.
Don't think that's right. People want more democratic control when they think that they can only do things via the state. I don't need to vote on what I wear in the morning. I don't need to vote on what shopping I do. As the power of the state expands, you lose control of your own life. And then you think, well, I have to therefore control the democratic process. But of course you can't do that. You're just one vote in millions. Even in a very small country, you've got a very tiny share of the say. So people, of course, are going to feel frustrated insofar as the government expands its domain. And no amount of democracy can solve that problem. You need to withdraw the state's power. So, I mean, of course I would say this, I'm from the IEA, but I think people would be a lot less frustrated if they didn't have to always act through the government.
To be honest, I think I'm trying to make a point about centralisation, and I think the democratic methods in our country are highly, highly centralised. And I mean, you just need to look at the current government and the decision making over the Brexit process. The idea that we don't have a highly, highly centralised executive in this country is a whole democratic process, not just executive. Well, it's pretty obvious to me.
It can feel nearly impossible to navigate. I'm sure something we'll talk about, Mark.
I'm going to suggest there's actually more commonality between Rebecca's view and Jamie's. I think what we're witnessing, notwithstanding what I've just said about the sort of extraordinary stability of the British government, all things equal, but what we're witnessing is the collapse of the Western social democratic state, actually, or at least the collapse of faith in it, if not in the collapse in the state itself. And now, this is, to my mind, both an exciting and a terrifying prospect. It's exciting because I don't really want there to be a social democratic state that runs my healthcare and my pension and tells me where I've got to go to school or university or how much I've got to save for my old age, et cetera, or what house I can live in. So I'm glad that's dying off, and I think it is unsustainable in the modern era. The scary part is that it's under threat because of a kind of collective, not very unified scream. So people are just shouting about it. Partly, as Jamie says, it might be that they haven't thought through their inability to control it. So they're demanding all sorts of chops and changes or more money being spent on it for their particular piece on it. But partly, I think it is just a cri de cœur. People are just saying, this is out of control. I hate politics. I hate politicians. I hate the state. I want something completely different. Unfortunately, some of the things they're voting for are, in my view, pretty unpalatable. So this could end up nasty if what we're witnessing now is the equivalent of the Weimar Republic. It could end up good if, however, what we're witnessing is the downfall of an over-encroaching state, and sooner or later, even if the forces at the moment have not found a decent tone of voice, that could actually act for liberalisation. So I think there's a lot at stake, but what we're really seeing is the Western social democracy in collapse.
Jamie, do we just give far too much time and attention to politics? I mean, sure, there's been all this upheaval, but do we just need to focus on the good in the world and the fact that every year that we move forward, the world tends to be becoming a better, more prosperous place? Would we all be a bit happier if we just calmed down?
Well, outside of the political domain, things are going quite well. So science continues to progress, technology, medical technology advances, and you know, all the goods, the services we get through the private sector are improving. So there's a lot to be happy about. But because more and more is taken under the umbrella of politics, because regulation keeps extending, we have to attend to politics. People's livelihoods depend on it, and so it's very difficult to ignore it. We could try to ignore it. I think people who do ignore it, unlike us, are probably happier. I mean, I guess most of the population don't pay much attention. They just go and, you know, have a roast meal and talk about the sport and so on, and they're probably a lot happier than we are. But I think Mark's right. We're coming up to something quite dramatic, I suspect. I mean, a lot of the welfare states in Europe are effectively insolvent. I mean, they would be insolvent if there was normal accounting applied to governments. So something's going to give. Since there's not much an ordinary person can do about it, they might as well ignore it.
I want to move us on to our Person of the Year pick. Mark, let's start with you. Who have you picked?
Oh, this was pretty easy. And reflecting on what's been said about we all spend far too much time talking about politics, absolute standout, easy winner, Gareth Southgate, England's manager. England came within a whisker of winning the Football World Cup. As you might have gathered by now, I'm fairly obsessed about football. But there was something underlying it, which I think was actually almost rather touching, that it brought the nation together, England at least. I'm not quite sure how many people in Scotland were cheering us on. And so I actually thought, with all of this political chaos going around it, and apparently we were the most divided nation of all time and everybody was turning in on each other, the fact that a football team who were given absolutely no chance really at the start came so close to glory was a culturally unifying factor, not just a sporting achievement.
Jamie, I think you want to weigh in on Gareth, but you also have a Person of the Year, so
no,
weigh
no,
in
I don't.
First.
I don't want to weigh in on Gareth or my Person of the Year. I want to say, I think there's something important about sport in this regard. New Zealand, the Legatum Prosperity Index came out recently, and I think New Zealand came top. I'm not sure. It certainly came top on the category of social capital, trust, basically. Partly because we're small. Small countries tend to have more. But I honestly believe that the All Blacks and the obsession with the All Blacks in New Zealand is a genuinely unifying force in the country that improves social capital and makes New Zealand a more functional country than it would otherwise be. And that sounds crazy, but I really think that that one sports team and the devotion of the entire population to it is quite an important part of why New Zealand is a successful society. And so I'm backing up Mark's point. I think this stuff is more important than a lot of people would think.
But what we were actually saying about how many people ignore politics, and it's not just about social cohesion. I write a regular column for The Times, and in my most recent piece, I sort of made the point that if you were a Martian and you just came down and looked at the sort of economic statistics in the UK and the crime statistics or whatever, you would generally think this is a fairly normal period. Actually, not obvious that there's been any particular disruption or dislocation in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, there's nothing spectacular here. Everything really looks rather average in terms of growth and salaries and inflation and everything else. There are a few outliers, but not many. So back in the real world, we seem to be enormously more robust and less dependent upon the political infrastructure than many involved in the political infrastructure would like to have us believe.
Rebecca, I don't think Jamie's remarks sound crazy at all. I mean, I think that England, at least, but I think the whole of the UK, was a much happier place over the summer when people were, you know, coming together and celebrating big wins. Did you feel the same?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this sort of almost plays slightly into something I was thinking about in the answers to our previous segment, which is that we've got to be careful not to just value stuff which is kind of economic, you know, in terms of the kind of trappings of a life, in terms of what your income is. There are some more key important things, I think, underneath that, which is why I think that stuff, why I think free exchange or why I think free trade are important, is because we are individuals. And within that is some of that stuff, I think, came out in the Indian Supreme Court ruling. It's a point about having dignity. It's about having choices about how you live your life. And sure, we may want to ensure that people have the best opportunity to do that. We may want to ensure that they have kind of continuing amounts of economic growth. But underneath that, beyond any of that stuff, I think has to just be the freedom to spend our life choosing to do the things we want. We can't determine the other things. And once we try to determine those other things, we get rid of the things that make life good, whether that's kind of virtues when the state comes in and crowds those things out by trying to mandate where we give our money rather than allowing charity, or indeed trying to get in the way of kind of culture and social stuff. Once the state kind of tries to drive those things and doesn't let it happen naturally, we lose the stuff that actually makes life good and that underpins why we might want to engage in economic activity.
Well,
and support
I'm going to come to you at the end for your person of the year, because I think that person relates to a lot of what you just said about central planning. Before that, I want to hear Jamie, who you picked as your person of the year.
My person of the year was the philosopher Roger Scruton.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about who Roger Scruton is?
Roger Scruton is a philosopher. He's a very wide-ranging philosopher, actually. He's covered a lot of areas within the subject. He's covered political philosophy, the aesthetics, parts of metaphysics, and so on. He's really very, very wide-ranging, but he's probably best known as a conservative political philosopher, one of the few. And he got appointed to some kind of a committee, government committee, that I disapprove of, as it happens. It's got its role as partly in trying to decide what buildings should look like in the UK, and I don't think the government's got any place doing that. Nevertheless, he got this job, and a lot of people, there was a kind of, you know, mob against him again. You know, he's said all these dreadful things in the past, and he's got to be fired from the position. And in response to that kind of activity, a lot of people buckle, and they apologize for the things they've said in the past, and they step down. And he didn't. He actually linked people to the articles that had caused the offence. I think it's so important that people stand up to this stuff, because if they don't, we're going to have a society in which it becomes too dangerous and difficult to stick your head above the parapet, and any decent person will absent themselves from public life. And it's very important that we resist this mob behaviour that's taken off over recent years.
And that's so often linked to this concept of identity politics and no platforming and real attacks on free speech often, which has become in many ways an arm of a more radicalized left-wing movement. Rebecca, who's your person of the year?
So my person of the year is Jeremy Corbyn. And that's not an endorsement, it's a recognition of his success.
And what do you want to recognize?
I think he has a vast amount of power. I think he's played a bit of a blinder with Brexit, playing people off against each other. I'm sure that'll, you know, have to come to a head at some point. But at the moment, I think he holds the power. I mean, people talk about a second referendum. I mean, I don't think that's something that Corbyn wants. And I think if you look at his advisors and the people around them, when you look at what Len McCluskey has explicitly said, he's always been informing Labour MPs that they shouldn't be voting for that. Similarly, Seamus Milne has these views. I don't think Corbyn is a Democrat, but I think he has all kinds of reasons why he's massively opposed to a second referendum, largely because he's key within the Lexit movement. There are all kinds of great left-wing reasons to determine what we mean by left-wing, but you know, whether it's to vote for Brexit. I think Corbyn, I think he's played a blinder about that. I also think he's increasingly likely to become Prime Minister next year sometime. I think he continues his takeover of the left in the UK and shifting the Overton window the way in which he wishes it.
I heard a little bit of a prediction there, but we'll come to those at the end. But there's no doubt that while the Conservative Party has been preoccupied with this one issue of Brexit for 2 years now, Corbyn has definitely been shifting that Overton window, and the arguments and the interest in socialism is rising up again. Mark, do you recognize the way that the UK is engaging in these kinds of arguments now?
Yes, I do. I mean, it would have been considered almost impossible 10 or 15 years ago, I mean, 5 years ago, that somebody of Jeremy Corbyn's ideology would be leader of the Labour Party, or that if such an eventuality occurred, that he'd be leader of the Labour Party for much more than 5 minutes before he was thrashed in an election and removed. So although I think there's very little common ground in policy terms between myself and Jeremy Corbyn, there's some, by the way. I'm a bit of a pacifist compared to most people on the Conservative benches, as is Corbyn, and there might be other areas of agreement. But it shows what I was referencing earlier, that there is a radicalisation of politics outside of Westminster. Corbyn is not propping up the social democratic consensus. He wants a radically changed world. He has shown, I think, not necessarily that people have been persuaded of some hardcore socialism, but that if your story and narrative begins from the system is totally broken and needs to totally change, you will then get a hearing for virtually whatever words come out of your mouth next. And I think that can be replicated by people of all different types of ideology.
Jamie?
That's optimistic, I think. You'll note that almost all the people who are saying the system is broken and are getting support on that basis are either authoritarian left or authoritarian right, as you see across in some parts of Eastern Europe. Nobody who's saying what we need is more economic liberty is kind of getting a good hearing by complaining about the current system. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the left have done a jolly good job of suggesting that what we're suffering under now is laissez-faire neoliberalism. That has been basically bought by everybody, and they're going, okay, we need some alternative to that. And authoritarians on the left and right are suggesting alternatives, and that's why it's a scary time.
Well, this is it, isn't it, Rebecca? It's not just the figureheads. It's the ideas of socialism that are coming to the front again. And not just that it's another way. Another way is possible, I believe, is the quote from Jeremy Corbyn. But that capitalism has failed, and that we experience what we don't like in the market right now is the failure of capitalism, as opposed to the controls of the state and that crony capitalism that so often creeps in.
It doesn't really surprise me. Over the last couple of decades, we've had very, very similar kinds of people in power, or at least that's certainly how it's been perceived to be. I've got a load of friends who are kind of moderate left-wingers who just don't feel that there's been a party that represented them. So I think when you're in that kind of position, you're more likely to see that somebody who's a bit more extreme might become seen as a, you know, realistic person for you to vote for. I think you have like a list of things like cutoff points that you're not going to go for. But I think if you feel that you haven't been represented, and again, I'm not necessarily saying this is right and true, it's a perception point. It's
the
a point
about
narrative.
The whole thing's been moderate left-wing. Tony Blair was a classic. I mean, surely they thought Tony Blair represented them, your moderate left.
But it's still
friends.
A point. It's still a point about left having moved into the centre. I mean, you look at Tony Blair getting rid of Clause 4. This is a point that, you know, they didn't feel, whether that's correct or not, I think there was a genuine feeling that everything had kind of amalgamated in the middle. And those people who had these kind of highfalutin ideas about, you know, sharing out the proceeds of wealth or about access to, you know, somebody else's house or whatever. I mean, I just feel we might think it's crazy, but I think even a moderate version of that, they felt that that just wasn't at hand. And you look at Tony Blair and his global interventionism and his kind of smiling posh boy looks, and it just doesn't feel as if these people were represented. So they go for something extreme. It's happening across Europe.
Mark, is there any argument into letting people who are becoming sympathetic to socialism do so, that so they can understand how it actually plays out and ends?
I'm not particularly attracted by that argument. That sort of, I'm not sure where that leads you. You know, if you haven't fully appreciated the historical lessons of Nazi Germany, we should do what exactly? I'm not sure reenactment of human horrors is the best way to sort of inoculate people with the sort of, this the flu vaccine argument, isn't it? You sort of stave off full-blown flu by giving people a bit of an injection of it. So sort of, you know, a few gulags and people will suddenly remember or return to the history books are not attracted by. I think there's a big problem classical liberals, free marketeers, libertarians have here. I don't have a solution to it. And the problem is that for reasons that we've outlined already, people are extremely angry. And classical liberals are very phlegmatic, philosophical and rational people. That's why I get on with them. And I'd like to think that's one of the reasons why I am one. But that means we're not tapping into the zeitgeist. Our response to people saying, what the hell is happening? Real wages have only just caught up with inflation. Or, you know, why doesn't anything sort of work properly? Or, you know, why is economic growth so sluggish? Our response is to furnish them with a well peer-reviewed monograph. That has merit. I mean, I do believe in the battle of ideas. But we are not standing up and being angry. And to what? That doesn't mean that you need to be vile or vulgar. But to Jamie's point earlier, that it's the authoritarians who are the hard right and the hard left who are winning. That's because liberals, in the true meaning of the word, stand up and say, in response to everybody's fuming anger, hang on a second. I mean, that's sort of how the speech starts. Not, I'm furious that this company has just been destroyed by red tape and bureaucracy, or have had inspectors storming into it and shut them down. This is a human rights abuse as well as an economics abuse. I don't think it's the role of a think tank necessarily to do that. But I think that somebody in the political arena who did that would be able to tap into support.
I do think there's also opportunity for positive emotion to play in our favor. So I'll abuse my position as chair, but my person of the year is Alice Marie Johnson. This is the woman who was given a life sentence in prison without parole because she was a small part of the drugs trade 22 years ago. And after spending almost 22 years in prison, American celebrity Kim Kardashian heard about her story and about her mass rehabilitation in prison and the fact that she had come so far and was very well loved and was an upstanding citizen in every way except her record, actually lobbied the President of the United States to release her, and he did. And this is a story.
Well, your personal idea should be Kim Kardashian.
Well, she's
Donald Trump.
Or Donald Trump.
Oh dear, Kim. I'll let Kim come a close second. Donald, unfortunately, has done a few other things this year that have downgraded him in my book. But my point is that her story is truly one that classical liberals, not the authoritarian left or the authoritarian right, should get behind. It's about changing prison sentencing and prison reform. It's about drug liberalization. It's about recognizing individuals as opposed to numbers behind bars. This story went viral, and these are also stories we can get behind. It doesn't have to be all doom and gloom. Jamie, surely there is some argument to be made about making that positive, or putting forward that positive narrative.
No, I think Mark's right. I think he's dead right. When I was listening to that, I thought that's bang on. It's anger that's winning the day. And if you act all rational and say, no, actually things are pretty good, and I can show you this chart which shows you that things are getting better, nobody will listen. And again, he's also right, it's not for us. An effective politician who believes in our stuff but can really get across how harmful the government regulations is and be a bit angry about it, it'd be very effective. I mean, Thatcher wasn't angry particularly, and Reagan certainly wasn't angry. He was witty and light of touch. But times have changed.
All right, well, I have two pessimists in my midst. Rebecca, are you going to say something optimistic?
Yeah, I am, actually, a little
Thank
bit.
Thank goodness.
Anyway. So to my mind, it's about making a kind of a bipartite argument. Half of that argument, I think, those of us on the kind of classical liberal side of things are very good at. Although sometimes we may do it in quite dry kind of peer-reviewed monographs. I completely agree, and I think there's definitely a place for that. But sometimes we need to take those figures out and say, X billion people taken out of poverty, or pick specific examples, this woman living in sub-Saharan Africa who didn't die in childbirth. Those kind of consequence-based arguments for the kind of freedom that we believe in. The thing I think we're not so good at is looking at the kind of non-consequentialist approach. I think all too often, economists, particularly on our side of the argument, are consequentialists. They want to argue things in terms of the consequences. I have loads of problems with that anyway, but I also think it can lead to you being attacked by people on the other side because they think that you don't have any kind of heartfelt reason for this beyond just the sure end point. So I have problems with that already, but I also think we're just missing half of the argument here. I think if we can ground it in stuff like this, like exactly going back to what they're saying in the Indian ruling about autonomy and about dignity and about, the reason why we think people should be able to make these choices themselves, then I think we get a really strong, powerful kind of double argument. And that's the side I think we miss. And I think that's the side where it's easier to make an emotional claim when we talk about people's rights, natural rights, as human beings. I think that's sometimes what we miss.
Mark,
we look at statistics instead.
Yeah, I'm not saying that we should abandon rationality. We'll only ever win if we've got the well-thought-out, well-researched arguments on our side. And that means the armoury of IA monographs going back decades is actually really important artillery. But somehow or other, we've got to get better at illustrating the arguments in that material, not merely producing further examples of it.
Let's move on to our final talking point, predictions for 2019. Now, we're lucky enough to have someone in the studio who was forced to make a prediction last year, predictions for 2018. Mark, you made a few accurate ones. You suggested that in America, the political landscape wouldn't shift too dramatically. It is true that the Democrats took the House, but actually there wasn't some massive slide in their favor and Congress is split. You said that in terms of Trump and Brexit, things would keep rumbling on and there would be disagreements over that. That's certainly true. But I can't give it to you for 2018 because you led with politics will be boring.
Yeah, I'm going to defend that prediction. I mean, what I perhaps should have said, it was politics will be tiresome and tedious and everybody will be sick of it. The mere fact that there's lots of hullabaloo happening does not of itself mean that it's exciting. I don't equate chaos and excitement. And in fact, we seem to be sort of trapped in a Groundhog Day. We can't actually move anything forward. So we're having exactly the same arguments about the same things every goddamn day. And that is ultimately boring. So we've got the worst of both worlds at the moment. We have complete chaos. And worse than that, it's extremely tedious chaos.
All right, an interesting defense of yourself. Perhaps our listeners will give it to you. Rebecca, now that you know you're under the pressure to be held up for what you say next year, are you willing to give me your prediction for 2019?
Sure, I guess I made a mini one by saying I think Jeremy Corbyn might well be Prime Minister this time next year.
You did, I heard that earlier. Yeah.
But that's not going to be my official prediction, so that way I can kind of claim it.
Very clever.
Either way, I think I'm going to hedge on this one. My official prediction is going to be extreme Eurozone unrest. And I think this is something which is actually already happening. And I'd extend that actually out wider than the Eurozone. But the point I want to make is a point about the kind of EU's rhetoric over its actions and its involvement in that unrest.
Mark, what's your prediction for 2019?
My prediction is that Gareth Southgate will lead England to glory in the European Nations League in Portugal in June, thereby lifting the first silverware for England since 1966. And I very much hope that happens. And that will be, if Brexit goes ahead on time, just a couple of months after the Brexit leave date. And it will be a little bit like Denmark won the European Football Nations Cup in 1992, just after they had voted no to the Maastricht Treaty. And I'll never forget, I think it was their foreign minister at the time, but one of the leading Danish politicians who'd campaigned vigorously in favour of the Maastricht Treaty, was asked his reaction of Denmark then winning the European Nations Trophy. And he said, it just proves it, doesn't it? If you can't join them, beat them. I wonder whether that might be the... Nice. But that's a slightly jokey point, although I'm looking forward to a football tournament sort of every summer now. My more serious prediction, and actually what you didn't reference back, Kate, from last year, is I said I thought we would see in 2018 the first signs of the EU cracking up. I didn't reference particularly the Eurozone. And I would say that we are seeing the first signs of that. The Macron's popularity is on the floor, violence on the streets of Paris. The Merkel era is coming to a close. Italian politics is in even more of a catastrophic mess than it usually is.
So you're backing Rebecca's prediction.
Yeah,
to some
I think
extent.
That will continue. I mean, I think it can continue quite a long time before the Eurozone actually blows up or the EU collapses, but I think we'll see that. But my prediction is that we will possibly in Britain break out of the cycle of just repeating the same arguments with the same politicians across the same dispatch box that we've had in 2018. That the forces at play in the United Kingdom, I think, are now very, very serious and severe in terms of the ideological divisions in society, not really reflected in Parliament. And I think there are going to be huge pressures on both the main political parties. And I think it's possible, I'm not saying it's likely, that you will see both the major political parties fracture in the next 12 months. Political debate and debate about economics and philosophy in Britain is beginning to become ideological, and the party system doesn't really reflect that in any meaningful way. And I think at some point it's going to have to catch up, and that will be a pretty brutal and painful process for those who are involved in Westminster.
And Mark, am I right in thinking that you think a major trigger of a potential party split or multiple party splits would be Brexit?
Yeah, I think that probably is the trigger, but I don't think it's that we'll have new political parties just defined on whether they're for a hard Brexit, Canada Plus, or the Norway option. I think that the sort of where you stand on Brexit often speaks to your ideological background. So if you were to look in the Conservative Party, for example, it has many different coalitions of different ideologies in it, of which only a fraction is classical liberal. Brexiteers tend to be those who are of a more free market persuasion, that thinks the government is too interventionist, by and large. And those on the Remain side are more technocratic in their approach to politics. I'm trying to say this as objectively as possible. Similarly, on the other side of the aisle, I mean, they sort of want more of a sort of Benite siege-style economy. We'd probably be quite happy for Britain to be out. The wing of the Labour Party that's lost influence over the years, the more moderate wing, are Remainer-orientated. But that doesn't mean they'll just hook up with other Remainers. It's because Brexit, that you can approach from all sorts of different angles, tends to be speak to what's in your heart ideologically, and that's all been brought to the surface by this protracted constitutional process we're going through.
Jamie, I want to bring in your prediction, as it might grate against Marx ever so slightly. You also have a sporting prediction.
Oh, yes. Well, the All Blacks will win the Rugby World Cup.
Okay.
That's quite a safe prediction.
And what is your meaningful and real prediction for 2019?
That at the end of it, the United Kingdom will still be in the European Union. Now, the reason I think this is that we're approaching no deal. It seems that we're moving in that direction. Theresa May's deal is very unlikely to get through. But there's no majority in Parliament for no-deal Brexit. So there'll be a very strong moves. I mean, some people are trying to get a second vote. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. In the short term, I don't think they're going to get a Norway deal or anything like that. So I think there's going to be a very likely that they'll extend the negotiations, will stay in. And then the forces at work in Parliament will be moving towards either no Brexit or just continually pushing it down the line, or a Brexit that is so soft that we're effectively still in. So we'd still be in the single market and the customs union, still have free movement of people and so on. So my prediction is that we just won't get Brexit done this coming year.
It's a very bold prediction. Rebecca, a lot of people will be dismayed to hear that, sure, because they voted leave, but a lot of Remainers just think, gosh, can we just get this done and dusted so we can move on to the issues like housing and healthcare that really matter to us?
Yeah, that's right. I think it would be incredibly depressing, and I think it would be kind of worrying for very worrying precedent to set.
Do you think it's possible that it won't get done in 2019?
I think it entirely depends on what you think Brexit is, what you think leaving the EU is. I mean, I agree with Jamie. There's certainly a reasonably strong likelihood that we may still be within the single market and the customs union. Whether that will be a temporary measure with an endpoint is still up for grabs as well. I've been endlessly frustrated and disappointed by people's seeming ability to ignore the need to respect what was a democratic vote. And I think that the frustration that is bubbling up against that has some potentially worrying consequences, but also could set such a dire precedent, not just here but also abroad, that I'm an eternal optimist, so I have to believe that this will happen. Because I don't really want to think about the alternative. But yeah, it's absolutely, I think I agree with Jamie, it's absolutely possible.
Mark, if every prediction from the three of you came true, the UK would still be in a European Union and closely tied to a Eurozone that's going through massive upheaval whilst splitting its own party, so there would certainly never be a majority in Parliament to actually come to the answer. That doesn't sound like the best case scenario for the UK in 2019.
Sounds pretty plausible there, doesn't it? That all three of those predictions hang together in some sort of way. Look, I don't know, and everybody sort of says, you know, what? These are sort of, I think at our IA Christmas party, David Davis, our speaker, said that next year will be an inflection point. And I think that's probably right. But short of saying that I expect there to be pressures on the established political system, I don't really know how it's going to end, but we're about to witness the unstoppable force hitting the immovable object. And whether the unstoppable force keeps going or the immovable object blocks it, I don't know. But you can be pretty certain that a lot of sparks will fly when that scientific political calamity comes about.
There's a lot to ponder about 2019. I wanted to be able to say a lot to look forward to, but the three of you haven't really given me that option. So what I will say is thank you so much, Rebecca, Mark, and Jamie, for joining me. And to our listeners, regardless of what comes our way in the new year, have yourself a very Merry Christmas.
For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.